Research and writing in the literature as a Christian calling. This webinar is going to cover the Christian missional call to discern truth and share evidence in the literature. We'll be touching on measuring and evaluating results that matter, doing literature searches, the various types of research, and the process of writing up scholarly papers for publication. And our speaker is Dr. Daniel O'Neill. Daniel, MD, MTH, is the founder and managing editor of the Christian Journal for Global Health, which is a scholarly, multidisciplinary journal. He is a writer and a co-editor of the book All Creation Groans Towards a Theology of Disease and Global Health, which was published just a couple of years ago in 2021. He's assistant clinical professor of family medicine at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, and he co-designed the Guide to Excellence in Evidence for Faith Groups from the Joint Learning Initiative for Faith and Local Communities. He also leads the Multi-Faith Evidence Working Group of the Moral and Spiritual Imperative, convened by the World Bank. So, Daniel, just a pleasure to have you back again on ICMDA webinars, and I'm sure there's lots of budding authors here really interested in what you have to say. Over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be back. And yeah, this important topic, I think, to be able to hopefully equip ourselves to not be shy about research, about discerning what God has for us. And that would be my prayer and my hope that many of you would be interested in being able to publish or research and let the light shine. So we'll getting to this, I'm privileged to have Elliot Larson, our editor-in-chief of our journal, that we'll have for the Q&A afterwards. So we'll go ahead and begin. So this is essentially about, why and how to publish. Now this is only really scratching the surface of a real extensive training that are available that I'll be able to provide at the end and on the email when we send it out tomorrow. So this maybe would be just a sort of an introductory lesson, if you will. Hopefully we can accomplish what we'd like to accomplish by looking at the Christian mission call to discern and share evidence, the why, where, what, and how of research and writing. Of course, we won't cover every single detail, but we'll at least scratch the surface. We'll also look at measuring and evaluating results that matter, because not everything that we measure and evaluate matters to God or to others. Also, writing scholarly papers for publication, we'll touch on. I think we'll look a little bit at the distinctions that Christians bring to global health and some of the gaps that that is, can fulfill by God's grace and help. And also, we'll look a little at our own journal, the Christian Journal for Global Health, and if we accomplish that, it'd be great. So we'll first look at evidence. I mean, what is evidence? It's always good to look at what evidence is. It's the available body of facts or information indicating whether a belief or proposition is true or valid. Seems simple, but it's good to define what we're looking at. But it could be also anything presented in support of an assertion. So as you can see from this definition, evidence can be multifaceted. We also often, as clinicians, doctors, nurses, healthcare providers, dentists, we tend to reduce evidence to scientific biomedical evidence, but there's certainly much more than that that we'll look into. Research is the process of using established methods to investigate a problem or question in detail, with the aim of generating new knowledge. Of course, the new knowledge is what the human beings can know, which is limited, according to what God knows, as we can understand as people of faith. But it's observations also of the knowable world that God created. So evidence from a Christian perspective helps motivate me and others, I think, to participate in procuring evidence looking at evidence. So we first see the great creation mandate in Genesis 1:28 about Adam and Eve being given dominion over the animals, over nature, trees, the biosphere, naming and stewarding the earth. We also see Solomon, the king of Israel, who did not request riches, but requested wisdom, that he would be able to discern and to distinguish the difference between good and evil. And God granted him that and gave him wealth. Also, testing the spirits. The first epistle of John said, test the spirits to see if they are from God. And so there's that idea of testing that the New Testament church is called to. And Jesus himself invites us to follow the evidence. In when he was speaking with Thomas, he said, you know, touch my hands, touch my side. And the Holy Spirit in the book of Acts, the apostles said, it seemed right to us and to the Holy Spirit to engage in an activity. So the Holy Spirit confirms collective wisdom. So what seems right to us as a collective is an important way that we move and live and have our being in the world. And then Paul writes to the Colossian church, calling them to wisdom. And then there's also the call to knowledge stewardship, not just stewardship of the planet and the biosphere, but also knowledge stewardship. In 2 Corinthians 10, Paul says, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. So we look at what works and what doesn't work in an ordered, testable universe that God created himself, a rational being. But it's not just to know about things, but it's to know things in order to promote life and godliness. Peter writes in his second epistle part of our work is promoting life, promoting health, and also the moral aspect of goodness or godliness. And also to make the most of every opportunity, as Paul writes to the Ephesian church, because frankly, the days are evil. So there's an efficiency that it comes from when we do research and writing. But it also avoids, by sharing information, by discerning truth, it avoids waste and duplication of efforts, which the scriptures speak of as dissipation. And it also is a call, the Christian call, to reflection, that would lead to action and peace. As Paul writes to the Philippian church, whatever is true, noble, excellent, praiseworthy, he writes, think about such things. And by thinking, we speak, and by speaking, we share. And that is both an encouragement and sometimes a rebuke, and sometimes a call to action and peace. Where do we find evidence? Well, we find evidence in the world. The cosmos is the New Testament Greek word. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. So we look at the biosphere, we look at nature, and as clinicians, physicians, nurses, dentists, we look at the human body as our focus, which is part of the biosphere and very intimately connected with the biosphere. So that's where we find evidence. We look at historical trends as well, what's happened in the past and how that informs present reality and how that might inform actions to either prevent something that did not work or to promote something that did work, and perhaps innovation to be able to improve on that. But we also look at the body of collective knowledge, which is part of the world. And we have this repository of information that is in the literature. in libraries, in books, and in journals, from which we can draw evidence. Then we look at testable realities across cultures. So if something works in another setting, cultural setting, another geographic setting, then perhaps there's a truth to that that is transcultural. But there's also culturally applied and locally manifest evidence that is something to remember, that there are sometimes contextualized truths. But we also look across disciplines. We find evidence. If we just stick with biomedicine, we miss a wealth of information, of evidence across disciplines of theology and sociology and other disciplines. And then we look at international standards, where we find evidence. We also find evidence in the word, that is the logos, 2 Timothy 3:16, that the word is useful for teaching, correcting, rebuking, training in all righteousness. So as Christians, we certainly find evidence in the scriptures, and that means that we have to exegete the scriptures properly in order to discern this evidence. You know, even from the very beginning, the prophet Isaiah says, "Come, let us reason together." So God's invitation for us is to reason, to rationality. And as we spoke about Thomas, about seeing the wounded hands, but also the empty tomb, and that the women were sent out to proclaim the emptiness of the tomb, solid evidence for the reality of God. But it's also evidence in the manifestation of God's presence and activity, so that wherever his people show up, wherever they become his people, there's a manifestation of the presence and reality of God, usually in the way people treat each other in love and shalom. But also Jesus said that evidence is in the life, affirmation, and abundance. John 10:10, I have come to bring life and bring it abundantly. And then Paul writes in Ephesians 4:15, to speak the truth in love, not just to speak the harsh reality of truth, but to speak it in love and gentleness. And so what we do is we eschew fruitlessness and expose it, Ephesians 5:11. So why do we research? Just for knowledge, information, data, truth, authority, stories? No, these things lead to other things. So knowledge leads to wisdom, which is the application of that knowledge. Information leads to application, so that things can actually change things. Data can lead to development, improving the lot of people's lives, especially among the poor and disenfranchised. Truth can lead to transformation, and authority can lead to guidance, so that we know what to believe, who to follow. And then also stories, which, as we'll see, the literature is series of stories, parables, if you will, can lead to inspiration. And inspiration, of course, leads to change, changed lives, changed behavior. So we research also to give an account to God. As Job states, what is mankind that you make so much of them, that you give them so much attention, that you examine them every morning and test them every moment? So you can see Job recognized that God himself is a researcher, if you will. We also give an account to others within the body of Christ, sharpening that occurs. And Paul writes to the 2 Corinthians, examine yourselves, test yourselves. So that's the idea of self-examination and self-critique. And also we give an account through research to the world at large, the cosmos. Paul writes to Timothy, be prepared in season and out of season. Rebuke, correct, encourage with great patience and careful instruction. The reasons to do research. Well, we do research in order to acquire new knowledge, not just for ourselves, but for all of humanity, if you will, for collective knowledge, to enhance capacity for effectiveness. So it's not just about knowing more stuff, it's for about doing better work. To build on past knowledge, that's why we do literature searches. We look at the past and we build on it and contribute to knowledge. But we also explore innovations, which takes a degree of creativity, which again is the character of our creator God, giving humans imago Dei creativity to imagine new possibilities and explore innovations. But also to discern strengths and needs. So we look at communities. When you do research in communities, you see the strengths first and then perhaps the needs that follow. Then we apply science to human service. So we use the empiric methods in order to apply science, not just for data, but for development, for human service. And we create narratives which affect change. And many times when we write papers, we're basically speaking a narrative into the narrative. And sometimes we tap into God's meta narrative. We contribute to collective knowledge. And we challenge tradition and stasis. Reasons to publish. So we can do research. That's one thing. It's a whole other level of calling to publish. By publishing, we share novel knowledge. So if something is novel, it's publishable. And that allows us to participate in collective wisdom, to clarify and refine practices, and to advocate for the people that we serve. Let's say the patients that we serve or their population that we serve. But it also highlights our organization, which sometimes is helpful for gaining credence or affirmation of the organization that we work in. But publishing also builds constituents. Many times co-authors build relationships and create networks. It also creates dialogue about a topic, about an area of service. But it also leads to our own personal professional development, which is important, I think. For example, our journal has encouraged and built into many majority world authors and helping them in their development of their own professional goals. We also, I think, publishing builds to capacity building. So what do we research? Well, we're typically, as clinicians, we tend to focus on clinical information, research, biomedicine and dentistry. But also, I think there's the whole aspect of public health, sociology, then this interface between religion and spirituality and how that affects health. There's anthropology literature, like what does it mean to be human? And I think Christian health medics can speak into that. And then we can even research the Bible. As we said, the word is another source of evidence that we can exegete and contribute to greater knowledge. And then missiological, the mission of God, which is where most of my research has focused. So how do we research? First, we start with a clear research question, and that may be developed as we do our work. And then we search the literature, which is a way to see if anything has been written on that subject. And I think most doctors and nurses have do this sort of naturally. We find gaps in knowledge. We measure baseline and end line from an intervention. That's this acronym PICO, which is a population, an intervention, a control group, and then outcomes. And again, not just outputs, how many people you saw, but outcomes. What's the health outcomes? And then we collect the data. We analyze results. We apply the results in relevant contexts in our discussion. And then we synthesize conclusions. And those conclusions need to be based upon the data and not just notions or feelings or thoughts. And then, of course, we make recommendations based upon that. And that contributes to knowledge. When we get to the process of writing up our results, it can be somewhat of a daunting process. It can be challenging. Relevance is your results having some degree of applicability within the medical field or within the field of study. Then you look at novelty, which is really one of the criteria by which a paper is decided to be published. Is it novel? Does it say something different than everybody else has said? Instead of just saying this work confirms what's already known. We look at design, which means that there should be some degree of robust methodology used in the research, that it has to have some degree of power and good research methods. Then we look at responsible reporting. There should be ethics approval so that you don't violate any ethical guidelines. Adherence to guidelines such as what we use as the Equator Network, which I'll give a reference to at the end. And then there's definitiveness, that it should have the last word and not always just positive findings. It could be negative findings. But you have to say something more than just more research is needed. And also we look at efficiency, which is, you know, it should avoid waste, since actually 85% of research is essentially a waste of time, money, and goodwill. So you don't want to research what's unnecessary. And as our associate editor, Nathan Grills, says, aim high when you submit an article to a journal, but have thick skin. But also don't stoop too low, because there are journals that are not worthy of publishing in. But always consider, what is the point? What's the point of the article? What is the, what we call SOCO, S-O-C-O, which means single overriding communication objective. So every paper needs to have that. It needs to tell a compelling story. And again, story is something that we know about from the Bible, but research reporting and papers need to tell a story. We also use checklists. They can be your friends. These are reporting guidelines on how to do a certain method of study. And when you submit an article for people that don't have English as the first language, you don't have to worry too much about the perfect English, but it has to be understood to the editors. And Elliot and I work a lot with non-English speaking authors and help them, as part of our services, to help them to polish that English part. And choose a journal wisely and follow information for authors and focus on rigor, relevance, and ethical responsibilities. There are many obstacles to publishing that we often deal with. The tyranny of the urgent. We're so busy with patient care, for example, that we don't have time to do research. Individualism. We often think of the patient in front of us as opposed to the population we might be serving. And library access can be an issue. Limited resources in many different settings. So that organizations don't always put aside money for research. There's sometimes difficulty finding institutional review boards to assess ethical aspects of the research project. And then there's submission costs. Some journals cost a great deal of money to submit an article. And the peer review process, as this previous slide indicated, is can be somewhat daunting. But there's ways of overcoming the obstacles, which is to designate time for research, specific time, and to think collectively. That is not just in your own mind, but to tap into other minds through research. That includes internet libraries, can be quite useful. And even Hinari can be accessed as a biomedical public health research library via the internet if you have internet access. Then you recruit partners and data gathering, so you don't have to do all the data. And sometimes there's students that want to do projects that you can partner with that are glad to have their names as co-authors. Mostly understanding ethics, but having courage to pursue and the will to complete research and writing projects. When you do a literature search, you have to think of these principles here: currency, relevance, authority, accuracy, and purpose. And I give the reference here for more information on that. You have to look at the scope and the audience when you're publishing of the journal that you're seeking to publish in. There's different article types. You have to select the correct article type. Some articles are not peer-reviewed, others are peer-reviewed. There's traditional journals, there's open access journals like ours, which can be viewed and are more easily accessible to the world audience. You have to consider impact factor, site score, or H index, which are measures for how that journal is discoverable, that is, in the literature, and how many people cite articles written in that journal. We also look at the indexing, where a journal is indexed, and there's different repositories of collective knowledge where people, when they do research, can find your article. And a new issue is generative artificial intelligence, which is now a big topic in the publishing community. When people use artificial intelligence to prepare or do research on a paper, we're policy changing currently in our journal to have them disclose that they did use artificial intelligence and how they used it. And as Christians, you know, when we publish, we consider witnessing to the powers, that is, those who in academia and in business and in government, if we speak into that, then we have influence. And I think that's an important Christian distinction. In global health, which is our topic, we can see that one of the purposes of Christians is to ascribe to the Lord glory and honor and strength, First Chronicles 16. That Paul writes about truthing in love, as we mentioned. And that when we demonstrate and proclaim the good news, and part of that is being able to speak into the literature. And as this missiologist Wilbert Schenck writes, that men and women can be set free from life-destroying powers. And also clarifying, Paul asked the Colossians, "Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should." And then uncovering, Jesus said, "Let your light so shine." And so part of publishing is uncovering information. On previous webinar, I spoke about the value added of Christians in global health and the expansion of the global church, and how the Christian church adds people, power, presence, perspective, proclamation, and perseverance of the saints. So that's an important thing to display before a watching and wondering world. So we communicate health-promoting, life-affirming, and God-honoring knowledge, not just from the pulpit, and church. That's an important place of communicating this knowledge, but also the patient in front of us, the population, if you deal more with populations in public health, and as we would say, the metaphorical pen. As Paul writes this in 2 Corinthians 4, we believe, therefore we speak. So we speak up and into the world's literature, not to be ashamed of what motivates and informs us, as Paul writes in Romans, that he was not ashamed of the gospel, the good news, and that we practice honest appraisals, that is, not false humility, but true humility about our results, both positive and negative. We use numbers and narratives, images and words, but mostly we have courage to publish in the scientific and the theological literature. And again, this is not for boasting, but we are blessed to be a blessing to others, and part of that is expressing our results to a watching and wondering world and to our brothers and sisters, all for God's glory and the healing of the nations. Our journal tries to seek to fill this evidence gap with a vision for global stewardship and filling that knowledge stewardship, magnifying the voices of the church and the majority world, because our journal is quite unique. And what does it mean to, what does evidence mean? And also, what is the majority world populations saying about what it means to be healthy and what works and what doesn't work? Our readership is throughout the world. It's in English. We'd love to translate it into other languages. That's our vision for the future. I would just put a plug in for our journal that we're looking for quality authors, good peer reviewers, editors, marketing staff, and also advocates. So you can contact me, and be glad to put you in touch with any of those opportunities for you. We'll put some resources in the communication that we send out tomorrow. These are two papers that have been written in our journal about research, just what we were talking about here, more detail, and a couple of other resources that can help you in your process of discerning and sharing your results. So thank you, Peter. I look forward to the Q&A, where we would also include Elliot Larson, our editor-in-chief, who can also field some questions. So thank you, Peter, for your time.
Thanks very much, Daniel, for that really comprehensive overview. And we've got a time of Q&A now. So welcome to Elliot Larson. Elliot is joining us now. His career consists of 20 years in scientific research, 17 of them in the UK, 14 years in private practice as an internist and infectious diseases consultant in the US, and 10 years of teaching internal medicine and consulting in Afghanistan. And he has been the editor-in-chief of the Christian Journal of Global Health since its first issue way back in 2014. So Elliot is the editor-in-chief, Daniel is the managing editor. So you have both of them here to ask your questions or answer your questions. I wonder if I could just start by asking both of you just briefly to describe your own personal journey as a Christian researcher. What got you into research, and what did you find was helpful for you along the way to develop? We come first to you, Daniel.
You know, I think I've always been I'm sort of a child of the Enlightenment in the West growing up. So I've always been interested in science as a pursuit because it was more objective, or sort of was a way to discern truth from error. So that was even before I became a Christian. I think when I became a Christian, I applied some of that pursuit of discernment to the Bible, and then also to my science and to my medicine. And so it was an easy move, I think, from but I think I've seen a lot of people sort of going by notions and by feelings and by presuppositions that I think need to be brought to the test. And so I think that's part of my personal journey, is both in terms of theology as well as science and medicine, is that discernment of truth, which I think is a good pursuit.
Thank you. And Elliot, for you?
Well,
tell us about your journey.
I was a good student, but I really started thinking about medicine when I told God in my senior year of high school that I'd be a missionary if he led me in that direction. And there were ways in which in college I discovered that I could be a missionary by being a professional person, being a physician. And even though my last year of college I did a research elective in organic chemistry, and the professor at the end of it said, "Well, Elliot, maybe research isn't your field." And I think actually when I applied to medical school, I said the one thing I didn't think I would end up doing was being a researcher, which is not a good thing to say when you're applying to medical school. You never should say that. But I got admitted anyway. And then I did research for 2 summers. My third summer, I was a Smith Kline and French Fellow in Peru. That was administered not through CMDA at that time, but through the Smith Kline and French Drug Company had a fellowship. They gave one to each of 36 medical schools, I think. So I spent 4 years in the jungle, sort of like as a missionary with translator couples. And so I was okay for being a missionary, but one of my mentors in medical school suggested that I apply to the U.S. Public Health Service it was Vietnam War years. So I had a selective service obligation. So I applied to U.S. Public Health Service, and the first week of my internship, I got a telephone call from a lab at NIH inviting me to come and work in research at NIH. I think it was about the time that Tony Fauci was at NIH, but we've had different careers, obviously. And so I spent 3 years in research at NIH. It was the lab developing rubella vaccine. So it was a frontline lab. It was a terrific scientific experience. But I was recruited out of that to go as a missionary to Afghanistan. So I went and taught as part of a team under Indiana Loma Linda University to teach in a medical school in Jalalabad. I was there for 4 years. Then we had to leave. The police came and invited us to depart. So we ended up driving from Afghanistan to England. I had met a scientist in England previously. His name was David Tyrrell. He was head of the Common Cold Unit, and at the time, the deputy director for the Clinical Research Center, which was part of the Medical Research Council in connection with Northwick Park Hospital in Harrow. So I was appointed there as a registrar and eventually senior registrar and consultant. And I was I worked at the CRC until 1991, from 1974 to 91. Then they closed the Clinical Research Center, and I didn't want to move with our research group. They moved it to Nottingham, so we moved back to the States, and I went into private practice. The research at Clinical Research Center was quite productive. We came up with, it was virology, but we came up with a bacterial toxin, which eventually led to the understanding of antibiotic colitis as a clostridial toxin caused disease. So then I went into private practice. I had 3 boys in high school to think about going to college. And then in 2005, after 9/11, we took up the opportunity to go back to Afghanistan. And I taught in internal medicine there in an Afghan teaching hospital. And we came home in 2012. In 2014, I met Dan, who got around to suggesting I could be the editor-in-chief of this new journal. So I've done it since then.
Okay. So and say that the rest the rest is history. No, and it's fascinating to hear how the Lord guided you both along the way and opened various doors of opportunity. Dan, coming back to you, what advice would you give to, I'm thinking particularly of a young researcher, a newly graduated doctor, perhaps training in a specialty in a resource poor situation or a developing world situation, and wanting to advance in writing and research. What advice would you give?
I would give advice to say start small. Look at perhaps take an elective if you ever in a have that opportunity in research. For example, in my family medicine residency, we had one of the staff that was dedicated. He had an MPH. He was dedicated to research. So part of our residency program required a research project. So that kind of got my feet wet in a research project. I think I did something on laparoscopic cholecystectomies, outcomes, things like that. But just the whole idea of just, start simple, gather some data, try to find a mentor, somebody who has been published before, and then maybe reach out to some journals to, like we get, for example, I think LA can speak to this, but we get emails all the time with drafts of articles or even research projects. And we can give some preliminary feedback to say, well, that's, you need to do this or that, or that doesn't have enough power in it, et cetera. So that's a good place to start, I think, is to have first an inquisitive mind, and then to ask important questions, and then to seek answers. And I think not to be to maybe make that, in a sense, a percentage of your time, some part of your professional life.
Maybe I could speak to that a little bit. When I went to Afghanistan in 1970, we were working part of the time there in the public hospital, and we were seeing a lot of non-pulmonary TB. And so I asked myself, what is the burden of of everything we're seeing? How much does TB play a role in that? So I took some time and went through maybe a year or so of medical records, just seeing how many of our patients had TB, but it was non-pulmonary TB. But still, that non-pulmonary TB is a product of pulmonary tuberculosis, or the spread of TB by pulmonary means. So that really redirected our efforts from hospital care to doing more in the way of clinics and doing sputum testing and encouraging sputum testing for discovering cases of TB. So there wasn't anything to publish, but it was reflecting on our experience and then guiding where we thought our efforts would be best directed.
Thank you. Kenneth Tan is asking here, hi, Dr. Daniel, thanks for your presentation. I'm from Indonesia. Would you say there is a wrong motivation to publish papers? I don't think publishing in and of itself is bad, but I've seen people take on so much work and hassle to get the most number of publications. Unfortunately, I think I've caught a bit of this attitude myself, and I'm having trouble relating my research work with my faith. What would be your advice? Thanks so much. So, and I think that's a real issue that a lot of people struggle with, isn't it? Especially when they see seniors perhaps publishing for motives or in areas where there's not going to be great benefit for mankind.
Yeah, I think that self-reflection is important. Like, why are you actually doing this? So if you're doing it for improving people's lot and helping their health, let's say an underserved population, then I can't see how that could be, in a sense, prideful. As I mentioned, there's a 60-80% of research is complete waste. So there's that idea of stewardship from Genesis 1 is to say, do research that matters. Do research that matters for the poor, that matters for the gospel, that matters for God, for life and godliness, as was mentioned. And that might help. But also, I think to avoid virtue signaling, like by trying to publish more papers. Now, if you're in an academic position, like I have an academic position, but as an assistant professor, if I were a full professor at the university, I'd probably have to publish as a necessity, publish or perish. And even then, you even though you there's an obligation to publish, I think you can still have to you choose some discernment about why do you actually want to publish, and so maybe that helps Ken. You know, I remember I met Ken at ICMDA in Arusha, and he took our global health course, and I know he's still in training right now. So yeah, but I think you know, God weighs the heart, and we do have to be careful about, you know, what our motives are. Yes, thank you for reminding us of that.
Now, that's a challenging stat. 80% of published research is wasteful or a waste of time or whatever. Can you just give us some general categories of things that are a waste of time but get regularly published? What can we avoid the temptation of entering into?
You know, I think as a Christian, you may not want to, you know, sort of put all your eggs in a, you know, cosmetic surgery basket, let's say, or transgender research that promotes it. You know, so there's an ethical filter I think you have to have. But like, for example, like if Elliot did research on C. diff and it came up nil, was it a waste? Well, I mean, there's a lot of drugs that are, I think that it's true that in pharmaceutical industry, it's something like that. It's like it's almost 80% of all the research falls on hard times and doesn't produce anything. So there is a degree of, you have to accept the fact that there's going to be some negative results or non-results, but that's why I think that research design is really important. You have to start with a research project that's well-designed before you even get to the writing stage or actually data gathering stage. Maybe Elliot can speak to that.
Well,
Elliot, just to move to another. Oh, do you want to add something on that, Elliot? Go ahead. Yeah, please.
No, we get submissions where we would suspect that the research has been done merely as a requirement for advancement or for some purpose. So, but we still would judge that on the basis of the quality and the content of the work that was done. And on the other hand, my boss, David Turow, said that research which is not published is research that is not done. So that was something I had to take seriously.
Now, a lot of research, we know we live in a world which is in a large part hostile to Christian faith and values. And you've bordered on this, Daniel, already by suggesting that some research is ideologically motivated, that people are trying to back up ideas that they have through the selective interpretation of the facts or whatever. We've got another question here from Augustine Lutakwa, who's saying, how can we as Christians mitigate personal bias in our own writing, particularly in soft science disciplines, to ensure that our research papers are objective and with integrity? Do you want to come onto that first, Dan?
That's where I think we have to sort of leave our presuppositions at the door, and we have to look empirically at the evidence. We all have interests, and we have specializations that would lead us toward research in one particular area. But we have to be careful that part of it, I realized actually Peter and I were sitting in a class with at the Global Missions Health Conference. You remember that? We were listening to one of our colleagues there speaking about how even in papers published in JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, and Lancet, one of the high-end journals, 80% of their research can be disproven after after the fact. So, and there's a lot of a profit motive too in the pharmaceutical industry, funding research, which tends to skew the results. And then there's the ideologies that you mentioned that are actually at the editorial level. Some papers are accepted based on ideology. If you follow the rules, though, of research and reporting, they're quite good, and they do try to discern the importance of ethics, the importance of data that proves something, p-values, etc. So there is objective ways to do that, and I think following the guidelines are something that I would say is something that we do and something that a researcher should do.
Can we come back to the question of AI, which you raised? And of course, the world has changed unrecognizably just in the last 12 months with the growth of ChatGPT and other modalities. Elliot, what specific challenges is the new era of AI producing for you as an editor of a journal?
Well, Dan mentioned our request that people disclose if they've used AI in producing their paper. Finding out if someone has copied something from their references is not an easy task.
Yeah.
One of the things we are heavily dependent upon are our peer reviewers. I'm so thankful for the job that our reviewers do. We've got some terrific folks, and they come up with stuff that I would never have thought about. So I have to say, Dan and I read the papers that are submitted, and we may notice something. I have a sense, I've read some stuff of AI, and sometimes you have a sense that this has been, the style of it suggests that it's been generated not by the author, but by some other source. So I can't say more than just, you get a sense in which this is artificial.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how reliable that is. But we do review, we do depend on our reviewers very heavily.
Yeah.
I would just add that part of the problem with artificial intelligence is that it pulls from every different direction without citation, without reference, without authority. Mm-hmm. And many times, actually, there's a filter that we use for papers that actually highlights some things that have a higher suspicion for AI generation, for the verbiage. Mm-hmm. And also, if you look at AI generated material, they fake all their references. Many of their references are don't even exist. So you have to go through the process of looking to see if references are actually true.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new era right now in publishing. And also we require people to disclose AI use because there has to be some accountability in the research process with authorship and the data sources so that a human being takes responsibility for it.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. I'm tempted. I just want to ask you one more question, Dan, in closing, and just to pick up on an expression you used in your talk. You talked about the courage to publish for Christians. Can you just unpack a bit what you meant by the courage to publish and why that's important for Christian researchers?
I think the courage to publish means, because many times I think we're like little hidden, we're like scared squirrels, you know, wringing our hands and fearing somebody's going to accuse us of being a people of faith or a Christian. There's a lot of accusations against Christians for fake knowledge or fake news. So I think it's important to be truthful and to take the time to research, but then to not be afraid to be critiqued by editors like us. I mean, we're actually quite generous and gracious, I think, by God's grace. But you can be pretty rigorous process of publishing, and that takes courage. but also not just speaking about the value of God, but also defending yourself in a sense in your data.
Can I add to that? I think one of the, for our niche in publishing, people may feel inhibited because of English. And we do really work hard to try to help folks with English. That's something, I mean, sometimes it's just too much. And but on the other hand, I don't like sending manuscripts to reviewers where it's going to be difficult. The English is going to be an obvious inhibition. So that's a sort of pre-review revision that we will deal with the authors about. We'll do something in track changes and send it back and say, look, these are some changes we'd suggest before we send it for review, and would you agree with them?
Thank you so much, Daniel O'Neill and Elliot Larson, on research and writing in the literature as a Christian calling. Really helpful, encouraging, and specific as well. And we look forward to seeing you again soon on ICMDA webinars. May God bless you.